Welcome to the New Life Podcast, a ministry of New Life Presbyterian Church in Ithaca, New York. Today we have this week's sermon preached by Tim LaCroix, our senior pastor. Join us for worship each week at 10 o'clock at 950 Danby Road, Ithaca, New York. You can also visit us on our website, www.newlifeithaca.org. Now here's this week's sermon.
A reading from Paul's Epistle to the Romans, chapter 8, verses 16 through 24. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing of the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together with the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope, we were saved. This is the word of the Lord.
I'm going to play a video for you in a second. This short video clip is an interview of a man named Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry is a fairly famous British actor. If you are someone who watches British television shows, he was in the comedic troupe Fry and Laurie, who both appeared also on Jeeves and Wooster. He's hosted quiz shows. British are really into quiz shows. So he's a well-known person in the UK of television, film, and stage, and happens to be one of Rachel's and my favorite actors, not only because he's a brilliant actor, but he's also a very intelligent person, a very kind person, very empathetic person. But he's also an avowed and passionate atheist. And the clip I'm going to show you, he's being interviewed on an Irish television program that has to do with issues of faith. So that's all the setup I'm going to give. Let's watch this video together.
Oscar believed in as he died, in spite of your protestations. Suppose it's all true, and you walk up to the prayer gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically finish the Odyssey. I think I'm saying boat cats and children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there's such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I'm saying.
Do you think you're going to get in?
No, but I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to get in on his terms. They're wrong. Now, if I died and it was Pluto, Hades, and if it was the 12 Greek gods, then I would have more trouble, because the Greeks they didn't pretend not to be human in their appetites and in their capriciousness and in their unreasonableness. They didn't present themselves as being all-seeing, all-wise, all-kind, all-beneficent. Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac. Utter maniac. Totally selfish. We have to spend our life on our knees, thanking him. What kind of God would do that? Yes, the world is very splendid, but it also has in it insects, whose whole life cycle is to burrow into the eyes of children and make them blind. They eat outwards from the eyes. Why? Why did he do that to us? You could easily have made a creation which that didn't exist. It is simply not acceptable. So, you know, atheism is not just about not believing there is a, it is not believing there is a God, but on the assumption that there is one, what kind of God is he? It's perfectly apparent that he's monstrous, utterly monstrous, and deserves no respect whatsoever. Merely banishing, and life becomes simpler, purer, cleaner, more worth living, my opinion.
That sure is the longest answer to that question that I ever had in this entire series.
Now, you may be thinking that I'm showing you the clips so I can very quickly demolish his argument. And while I do understand, it's quite stark. I mean, it's quite blasphemous even what he says. But I'm not going to interact with his argument just yet, because what I want to do first is follow the model that we've been presenting in this sermon series. And that comes from 1 Peter chapter 3, that we are to be prepared to give a defense, but do it with gentleness and respect. How do we give an answer with gentleness and respect in this instance? I think, first of all, we have to do it by affirming what's true in what he said. If you read the online reaction to this video clip, you could guess what you saw. Christians getting very angry at what he said. But what is true about what he said? I think that the most fundamental true thing about what Stephen Fry said is it is awful. The suffering in the world is awful. The fact that children get bone cancer is something to be angry about. The fact that there are parasites whose sole life cycle is to bore into the eyes of children and make them blind, that's terrible. And so we can affirm with him that those things are worth getting angry over. And we can get angry with him about them. We would certainly disagree with whom we are getting angry. But we can affirm the anger, because where it comes from is a place of love and empathy for other people. And we can certainly say that there is a lot of suffering and evil in this world. And we should be angry and we should grieve it. So we can definitely affirm that about what he said. And that Stephen is ultimately coming from a place of empathy and kindness when he displays that anger. But what about respect? How do we treat his position respectfully? And for that reason, I'm not going to enter into a defense of God just yet, because I feel like, and maybe you feel the same, we need to defend God in this moment. Well, God doesn't really need our defense, first of all. But before I defend God, and I will, I want to first respect what he's saying by taking his argument seriously. Let's just play this out. Stephen Fry is an avowed atheist, right? And what he's angry about is suffering. We're angry about that too. And what he's saying is my worldview is actually a better place to deal with suffering. A better place to experience it. So let's play that out. What is atheism? What does an irreligious worldview give us in suffering? Is it really a better place? Is it really a better way to deal with the issue of suffering? Is it really a better way to cope with the suffering and pain in this world? If you are an atheist, a true atheist, not one who is also borrowing religious ideas, and many of us do. It's almost hard to divorce atheism from religion, because almost every atheist is in the center of a very religious environment. But if we truly remove religion from atheism, what do you have? Well, you have a world where what you see is all there is. You have a world where it is survival of the fittest. You have a world where our morals that we have are sort of, they have evolved within the context of the survival of the tribe. And so in such a world, there really is no meaning, is there? Author Rebecca McLaughlin points this out in her book, which I've been following, called Confronting Christianity. She quotes Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist who passed away a number of years ago. He had a motor neuron disease that made him so he could not walk and he could not talk. He invented a system so he could talk with the help of a computer. But Stephen Hawking, he said that basically we're just walking computers. You know, and he said that basically when we die, our brain is a computer that just stops working because its components fail. He said, there is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. If we're truly materialistic, that's what we are. We are sophisticated machines. And when we die, we're just switched off. Richard Dawkins is a fairly famous atheist. He wrote a book called God Hypothesis. And he states that there is no design, no purpose, no evil, no good. If you are truly materialistic and there is nothing else than what we see, how can we say what is truly good? How can we say what is evil? How can we say there's any origin or purpose to anything? And so I would posit this. If what we see is truly all that exists, who's to say that I as a human being have any more rights than a brain-eating amoeba? Doesn't the brain-eating amoeba have just as much of a right to exist as I? How can I say that brain-eating amoeba shouldn't eat my brain? If that is true and this is all that there is, then who's to say that the parasite which comes into the eye has any less of a right to exist than I do? That the cancer that eats up our bodies has any less of a right to exist than I do? It's very hard for us to grapple with this, but truly, if there is no hierarchy, there is no meaning, there's no reason why humans are better than other organisms, then why? Why? The only reason that I can think of, and I would admit that I'm not the smartest person in the world, but the one reason I can think of is because we're more sophisticated and we're more powerful machines. But is that truly an ethic we want to live by, that the more sophisticated, the smarter, and the more powerful have more rights than those who don't? In fact, does an atheistic, irreligious, godless system really have room for the rights of any minority? Why would any minority get any rights in the survival of the fittest? Why would any group outside my own clan, my own group, my own tribe, why would I care about their rights at all if it's truly about survival of the fittest and those who are powerful? And so I think that this system, I don't use the word godless pejoratively, just a system without God, it doesn't give us anything. And in fact, I would argue that that theistic religion gives us far more to help us cope with suffering than the irreligious atheistic system does. Because if Richard Dawkins is right, if Stephen Hawking is right, then why do we even wake up in the morning? There's no origin, there's no meaning, there's no good, there's no evil. On what basis do we have to get angry about suffering in the world? And so I would posit that it really isn't a system that helps with suffering. So that's sort of the first bucket of things I wanted to say. What does an atheistic worldview truly do for those who suffer? But the second is this. I do want to give a defense of God, and I do want to give a defense of what Stephen Fry was saying. You know, he's a very, very intelligent person, very smart, and he's educated. I don't know if he caught it. He said it very quickly and in a British accent. But he knows what the discipline, the philosophical and theological discipline of engaging with what is called the problem of evil, which is what his very passionate and articulate speech was about. How can a loving God, a beneficent, all-powerful God, allow evil to exist? That is called the discipline of theodicy. Theodicy. I think I spelled that right. Theodicy. He used that word. He said, this is called theodicy. He's very educated. He knows his stuff. He you know, as someone who grew up in England, is English, obviously has a Christian, some sort of Christian education. And this discipline of theodicy is about sort of defending or justifying God in this question of how can a loving God allow this? Because if we say, okay, look, our system, the theistic system offers us more in suffering than the question that follows, which is the question that he so eloquently and passionately and maybe even persuasively articulates is why then? Why does that God allow suffering? Why does that God allow bone cancer in children? Why does that God allow these things? He could stop them. Well, in order to answer this question, philosophers and theologians throughout the centuries have gone to the text of Scripture. And the text of Scripture actually presents a worldview. It presents a narrative that answers this question. And again, we're building off of a logical flow of things that began in the first sermon in this series, sermon number one, which was basically, it is a reasonable position to take when we observe the world around us. We see the beauty of creation, and Stephen Fry himself acknowledged that. He said it so fast you might have missed it. But he said, this really is a splendid world we live in, but he acknowledges this is a splendid world we live in. And it is a reasonable position to take when we observe the grandeur and the glory of this created world that we live in to say, I believe that an intelligent, all-powerful being created all of this. So if you want to review that, you can go back to the first sermon in the series. So building off of that, if we believe that there is an all-powerful, all-beneficent, all-knowing God who made all of this, who created us and everything in it, why does that God allow evil? We read it in Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3. This was the reading that John read to you. You may have wondered, why are we reading stuff about punishment at in the middle of the kind of the worship portion? I just needed a slot for the reading there. But this is important because in what I said to the children, you've already picked up on this a little. If we go back to Genesis chapter 1 and 2, we see that God made the world good. He made it good. And when he finished creation of Adam and Eve, he said, it is very good. So God made the world good. This is the narrative that the Bible is presenting to us. And again, if you have questions about the reliability of the Bible, you can go back and listen to sermons 2 and 3. So we're building on stuff here. The narrative that the Bible presents is the world was created good. In other words, God didn't make that parasite with the purpose of boring into children's eyes. God did not make that amoeba with the purpose of eating people's brains. God did not make hurricanes to come on land and kill people and destroy. The perfect created world would have had hurricanes, but they would have stayed safely off the coast. The seas would have stayed within their boundaries. And if the storm came on land, it would not harm any person. You see, it is actually the post-fall world that has these things. So Genesis chapter 1 and 2 says the world was created good, and then something happens in Genesis chapter 3. Adam and Eve were created on the sixth day. They are created, we learn according to Psalm 8 and other things, as the pinnacle of creation. Adam was the Lord of creation, and Eve was his right-hand helper. And as the Lord of all creation, he also, in some sense, represents it. In our theology, we call this, Adam was our covenant head, our federal head. Because he's made from the stuff of the earth. Genesis chapter 2 describes God making Adam from the dust of the earth and breathing life into him. So Adam is of the earth. In fact, Adam literally means dirt clod. He's dirt man, right? That's what it means. So Adam is of the earth and he represents the earth. And so what we read in Genesis chapter 3 is that Adam fell and Eve fell and they transgressed against God's law. And what John read was the origin of all the pain and all the suffering that we have in this world. As Augustine said, and I quoted to you earlier in the service, Augustine said, free will was the cause of our doing evil. and your righteous judgment of our suffering it. If you want to turn back there, you can, just to look at that reading. It's on page 6. So what we have is three curses. This is God's judgment on humanity for our sin. First of all, there is a curse on the serpent. And he says there will be enmity between you and the woman. And so what came into the world as a result of the fall is that there is enmity. There is fighting. There are people who hate each other. There's enmity in the world. And then we see that there is a curse that is given toward the woman. And he says, I will multiply your pain and childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. This does not only mean that labor will be painful. It means that the bringing forth of children will be hard. And all the parents said, amen. Bringing forth the next generation of children is hard. There is strife. There is tension between parents and children. This is what this is about. The pain of that. And there's also pain and strife within marriages. It says that your desire shall be for your husband and he shall rule over you. There's this strife and tension in a marriage relationship. That's a result of the fall. But then most of all, we get to Adam. And the judgment on Adam really is the judgment that is the most universal. He says, cursed is the ground. The ground is cursed. The very ground is now not what God made it to be because of Adam's sin. He says, in pain you shall eat of it. You're going to have pain, Adam. You didn't have it before. Thorns and thistles it will bring forth instead of the things you have planted. There's entropy, and not just entropy. Entropy that like Murphy's Law, like the cord that you wrap up so carefully and put into the, and then you come out and it's tangled like a rat's nest. I hate that. Thorns and thistles. Nothing will come out the way we thought it should come out. By the sweat of your face, you will eat bread until you return to the ground. The ground is cursed. And what we read in Romans chapter 8 that Angela read for us is a summary of Paul saying that the creation itself was subjected by God. This is an exposition of Genesis chapter 3. Subjected by God in order to carry out the judgment of sin. Just to kind of go over what Paul says here, starting in verse 19. He said, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. Why? Because the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly. In other words, the parasite doesn't want to do that. The brain-eating amoeba doesn't want to eat brains. The hurricane that comes onto the shore and destroys people doesn't want to do that. The creation did not do this willingly, but it was subjected. Why was it subjected? It says, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God, because we know the entire creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves. God cursed the ground. He put the earth, the creation, the storms, the parasites, the cancer. He put it in charge of judging and punishing humanity for our sin. And that doesn't mean that individual ailments are because of individual sins. Jesus makes that very clear. His disciples come and say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he is blind? And Jesus said, neither. This is a result of the general curse on all of the earth because of all of humanity's sin, not just Adam and Eve's sin, but all of us continually. So you can't place punishments, suffering, and apply it to individuals because they are X, Y, or Z. Unless they were actually boneheaded and did get themselves into that mess. It's pretty simple to prove causation. But this doesn't mean that someone who gets cancer has it because of their particular sins. No, it's a result of the general judgment of God on humanity. It's not God's fault. Why did this happen? It happened because God created us with free will. And these are the quotes that are on page 3. You can read them later, especially the one by Alvin Plantinga. God created us with free will. And if there was going to be truly free, morally good choices, he had to also allow for free will, immoral choices. And so he did. And as Augustine said in another place in a disputation with Fortunatus the Manichaean, unfortunately, some free beings chose evil. And that's how we got where we are, because God gave us free will. So we see, first, the atheistic system doesn't really give us anything in the presence of suffering. Second, we have our defense of God. It's not his fault. It is humanity's fault. But thirdly, I want to leave you with some hope. And that hope resolves around, how do we find meaning in suffering? And the question I have is it possible that there is a reason? Is it possible that there is a reason for our suffering? One of the ways that philosophers and theologians answer the problem of evil is they say, if three ifs in a row, if there was a reason, even if we could not grasp it, even if we couldn't state it, if there was a possible reason for the suffering that we experience, if there was a reason, a legitimate reason, then God would not be unjust for it. Does that make sense? If there was a reason. In other words, I don't know if you've been in a situation with a friend or a family member and they did something that you didn't understand, and later you said, you better have had a good reason for doing that, right? You probably think of a situation, or at least you know the situation I'm talking about. That's on very small terms. But if God had a reason, even if we couldn't explain it or we couldn't understand it, if he had one, then God would be just. Well, now I'm going to enter into something that I sort of thought up this week, and I'm calling it Tim's Mathematical Defense of God. For those of you who are, you know, scientists, engineers, mathematicians, you know of something called multivariable calculus. And I took this class called Differential Equations in college. I have no idea how I passed it. I think I told Felix this last year. I know I passed it. I understand what it is, and I kind of know what's going on, but I certainly couldn't do it today, and I don't know how I did it then. But the basic idea is this: if you have an equation with one variable, you can solve for x. That's algebra. You move it around, you manipulate it, you solve for x. But what if you have two variables? Right? You have to do something called a differential equation to solve for multiple variables, and it's this inexplicable. Felix could come up and give us a lecture, because I know he understands it, but I mean, you do too. But multiple variables require calculus, okay? So what if there are four variables? What if there are five variables? The more variables there are, you need a bigger brain, a smarter person, or a bigger computer to solve the equation. But what if, how many people are there on Earth? Close to 8 billion. What if there are 8 billion variables? And each of those 8 billion people have tens of thousands of choices. And then you put on top of that the trillions of organisms that live in this world. Who can solve that equation? Well, that's a finite number, isn't it? It is big, but it's finite. And if we just posited that the God of the universe who created everything is infinite in his knowledge, in his power, in his being, he can solve that equation. We may not understand it. We will never be able to understand it. The amount of energy required to build a computer like that would suck up all the energy in the world. But he can. He can solve it. And so what I posit to you is, if it is possible, if God is able to do it, then can we just acknowledge that God may have a reason for our suffering? So there's Pastor Tim's mathematical defense of God. And that leads us to this. And this is where I'll close. Paul in Romans clearly gives us some sort of reason for our suffering. If we go back to the passage, the beginning of the passage that we read, that Angela read for us, this is what he says in verse 17. If children, then heirs, if heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him, in order that we may be glorified with him. Our suffering has meaning. It leads to our glorification. Paul says in verse 18, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us." I don't know why suffering exists. I don't know why our loved ones get cancer. I don't know why these bad things keep happening to me and to others and all across the world, these things that happen. But I do know that suffering has meaning because the sufferings of this life are not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed in us. In other words, if we suffer for 70, 80 years here on earth, the most horrible suffering that you could imagine, what is that compared to eternity? The eternity of glory, the eternity of glory and bliss without any pain, without any tears. Paul says it is not worthy of comparing. That doesn't mean it's not significant, but it is encouragement to endure. But again, why? Why? In order to answer the why, I go to John chapter 11. And this is the best stab I can give you at why. In John chapter 11, Mary and Martha's brother Lazarus is sick and dying. And Mary and Martha have this hookup. They know a guy who can perform miracles. And so they send word to Jesus, "Jesus, our brother Lazarus is dying." Now Jesus could have like zapped him. He was like far away. He could have zip. He could have zapped him because we know he can heal it from a distance. He did it several times. With the ruler whose daughter, when they got there, she was healed. So he could have healed him from a distance, but he didn't. And he could have left right away and gone and healed him, but he didn't. And so the question is why? And it's very similar to the question that Stephen Fry was asking when Martha comes up and confronts Jesus. Jesus says, "Why? Why weren't you here? Why weren't you here? You could have saved him." Of course, she doesn't utter blasphemy like Fry did, but she has the same kind of question. And the first thing we notice is that Jesus weeps. So it's not that the suffering is significant and the Son of God weeps. And God weeps. And God is angry. As we read in the Psalms, he is indignant every day because of the suffering that we have here below us. But Jesus himself says, two things in John chapter 11 that are revealing. He says in verse 14 that Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus has died, and for your sake, I'm glad that I wasn't there." Whoa! Why did he say that? He said, "So that you may believe." And then later, he says, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall never die." And then he says, "Lazarus, come forth," and he does. Why did he wait? He waited because there was something greater that he was trying to accomplish, not just the healing of a friend, but the salvation of people, the eternal salvation. Why does he wait? Why does he tarry? Why does he allow? Ultimately, I don't know. But is it worth it? Is it a good reason? If that reason results in the salvation of how many Christians in the world now currently? 1 billion? 2 billion? However how many it is, when it's all said and done, would it have been a good enough reason if all those people were saved and enter into everlasting life? I will leave that to you to judge. Let's pray.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please rate and review us on your podcast service and share with anyone who may be interested. The intro and outro music for the New Life podcast is provided by Sandra McCracken with her permission. Please visit her website at sandramccracken.com. We'll see you next week.